Good evening. Welcome back to Wednesday Night Bible Study. I'm Richard Masurvey, and we are in the middle of the life of Elisha. Just so you'll know, the goal is to finish the life of Elisha in June, because then Pastor Sean will be starting the theology of the body in July, which means we have a lot to cover faster than I normally do, which means you can ask questions as long as they're easy and I know the answer. But if it's a difficult thing, then we don't have time for that. So I'll just have to skip over it. But we are in chapter 3. Last week, we saw how Elisha succeeded Elijah, and you remember, he asked for a double portion of the spirit that was on Elijah, and Elijah said, "I can't guarantee that, but if you see me when I leave, then that's what will happen." And sure enough, that's what happened. So he receives a double portion of the spirit that's on Elijah, being Elijah's heir, and then we looked at how the Spirit was demonstrated that he was the heir. You know, he guided the sons of the prophets. He executed the power of God to walk across the Jordan when he struck it with his robe. He spoke prophetic words of God's grace that it actually reversed the curse on Jericho and brought life from the water that was poisoned. And he also brought the prophetic word of judgment. And you remember the young men or young teenagers or young boys from Bethel had come out and mocked him as the prophet of God, and God's judgment was upon them. And so what we saw was the word of grace for those that were living by faith, were the remnant of God's people, and a word of judgment for those that mock the prophet. Because mocking the prophet is the same as what? Mocking the one who sends him. Mocking the word of the prophet is mocking the one who spoke that word. And the judgment of God then was on that culture. And we were challenged that it's a dangerous thing to have contempt for the true God and to mock and scorn him. And we saw, as Paul said, that God is not mocked, that whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. And so Elisha then succeeds Elijah as the premier prophet of the day. And now in chapters 3, 4, and 5, we see a whole vignettes of stories about the miraculous powers of Elisha. And the goal is to get through chapter 3 and 4, and chapter 5, we're not going to be able to have time to get to. However, there's a fabulous sermon on the website from last December when some fill-in speaker spoke on chapter 5. So if you're desperate to know a little bit about chapter 5, then that you can find that on the website. Now we're going to start with chapter 3. But did you think of anything during the week that you wanted to bring up before we move on? No? Okay, we're going to go then. No, if something came to mind that you thought would be important, you can speak now or we'll move on. All right, so we'll look at some Elisha stories. In chapter 3, 1 through 27, there's war with Moab. Chapter 4, 1 through 7, we have a miracle of multiplying the widow's oil. In 4, 8 through 37, we see a miracle of granting a son to the Shunammite woman and raising him from the dead when he dies. In the end of chapter 4, we have the cleansing of a poisonous or deadly stew, and then finally multiplying bread during the famine. So that's a lot to cover. So turn to chapter 3, 2 Kings chapter 3, and this will take us back into, we've been looking just at Elijah and Elisha, but now we're back to the ungodly kings that he has to deal with. So in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Ahab. Now, last week we saw Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, died. Now his brother takes over. So there's no, this is going to be the last king of the house of Omri. But so Jehoram, the son of Ahab, became king over Israel in Samaria. He reigned 12 years. And like father, like son, verse 2, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, though not like his father and mother, for he put away the pillar of Baal that his father had made. So not as bad as Ahab and Jezebel, but bad enough. the kings of Israel often say that. He didn't do this, but he didn't do that either. So nevertheless, verse 3, he clung to the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin, and he did not depart from it. Jeroboam was the one that set up the two golden calves for them to worship at Bethel and Dan. Now, verse 4, now Mesha, the king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he had to deliver to the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and wool of 100,000 rams. But when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So King Jehoram marched out of Samaria at the time and mustered all Israel. And he went and he sent word to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and the king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to battle against Moab? Right, so he's trying to get an alliance together with Judah, Israel, and Edom. And he said, I'll go. I'm as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. And he said, by which way shall we march? Jehoram answered, by the way of the wilderness of Edom, because he's going to pick up troops from Edom as well on the way to Moab. But it goes through the wilderness or the desert. So the king of Israel went with the king of Judah and the king of Edom. And when they made a circuitous march of 7 days, there was no water for the army or for the animals that followed them. And then the king of Israel said, alas, the Lord, or Yahweh, has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. Right? So there's no water, so this is the Lord's fault, and he gathered us together just to give us into the hand of Moab. And then Jehoshaphat, verse 11, Jehoshaphat says, is there no prophet of the Lord here that we can inquire of the Lord? Now, you would think that he would have done that beforehand. So this is the perfect example of neglecting the most important thing. Lois and I once had to drive up to Massachusetts for our nephew's wedding. And we got all the dress clothes, put them in the garment bag, hung them up on the closet door for us to take with us on the way out the door. Only we didn't take them out the door. So we got there and get ready to get our clothes and realize they're back in Trenton, New Jersey. And so, I mean, the most important thing wasn't done. And that's the case here. So the most important thing was not done, to inquire of the Lord and follow his way. The picture on the screen is what's called the Moabite stone. This was discovered and it has on it the text of Mesha the king that it was just referring to. And on that stone, it has all his exploits and victories. And wouldn't you know, this one is not in there because it's not a victory, as we'll see. But it's a real, I mean, we forget this sometimes. We read this, it's a long time ago. It's real people, real armies, real kings, real historical events that the Lord is using for his glory. So the question is, in the time of crisis, where do you look for help? And Jehoram doesn't know where to look, but Jehoshaphat does, and asks, where isn't there a prophet that we can appeal to? And notice then in verse 11, Jehoshaphat, is there no prophet that of the Lord here that we may inquire of? And then one of the king of Israel's servants answered, not the king, one of his servants answered, Elisha the son of Shaphat is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah. Right? The servant of the king knows there's a prophet, but the king doesn't know. And Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Edom, went down to him. All right, so that's the scene. They're getting ready to go to battle against Moab. They ran out of water. They're in the desert. The king is assuming they're going to be killed by the Moabites, and Jehoshaphat says, "Why not call the prophet?" And so in verse 12, Jehoshaphat said, "The word of the Lord is with him." So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. And Elisha, now, Elisha had to win friends and influence people. In verse 13, Elisha said to the king of Israel, "What do I have to do with you?" Right? We have nothing in common at all. What do I have to do with you? Go to the prophets of your mother and your father, right? The prophets of Baal. You're the ones that you follow. Go to them. But the king of Israel said, "No, it is Yahweh who has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab." I mean, he's got a lot of gall. Right? They follow Baal, but now when things look bad, we're going to blame Yahweh. And Elisha says, "As the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, were it not that I have regard for Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would neither look at you nor see you." Not the way to win friends and influence people. Yeah. And we saw the same thing with Elijah. Elisha's following in his footsteps. And then verse 15. "But now bring me a musician." And when the musician played, the hand of the Lord came upon him. So he asks for a musician or someone to play the lyre. Now, what do you make of this?
It was using the music as a way of quieting your soul, focusing, hearing from the Lord, attentiveness, maybe some receptivity to the Holy Spirit.
It's odd though, because we haven't seen him do that before, but in this case, he does, and there. I put on your sheet some other scriptures where music is involved, but it's not a common thing. You have it a couple times in Samuel and Kings and once in Chronicles, But it's not like every single time the prophet has a word from God, he needs the lyre. But in this case, he asked for a musician. And what makes this case different than others, I don't know. Maybe somebody has notes in their Bible that explains it all. But most of the commentators I read just skipped over it, right? But like I say, you know, if it's too hard, we don't have time for it. But so his word, the important thing is, so when the musician played, the hand of the Lord came upon him. So the musician may be an instrument, but what's necessary is for the hand and the word of God to come upon him. That's what he's looking for, and that's what he gets. And so he said, "Thus says the Lord, I will make this dry stream bed full of pools. For thus says the Lord, you shall not see wind or rain, but the stream bed shall be filled with water so that you shall drink, you, your livestock, and your animals. But this is a light thing in the sight of the Lord. He will also give the Moabites into your hand, and you shall attack every fortified city and every choice city, and shall fell every good tree, and stop up all the springs of water, and ruin every good place of land with stones." All right, so first of all, you're going to get your water is going to come. You're not going to see rain, but there's going to be water in pools. Second of all, you're going to have a victory, and you're going to go and bring destruction on the Moabites. So, but the next morning, and it's so nice when you have a word that gets fulfilled the next morning, right? Rather than, you know, like Abraham 25 years later. So the next morning, about the time of the offering, the sacrifice, behold, water came from the direction of Edom till the country was filled with water. And when all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to put on armor, from the youngest to the oldest, were called out and were drawn up at the border. And when they arose early in the morning and the sun shone on the water, the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood. And they said, "This is blood. The kings have surely fought together and struck one another down. Now then, Moab to the spoil." Right? They see the water, it looks red, and they assume that the kings have slaughtered themselves. But in verse 24, "But when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose and struck the Moabites till they fled before them. And they went forward, striking the Moabites as they went. They overthrew the city." Now they did exactly what Elisha said they would do. They overthrew the cities on every good piece of land. Every man threw a stone until it was covered. They stopped every spring of water and felled all the good trees till only its stones were left in Kir Hareseth. And the slingers surrounded and attacked it. And we'll stop there. So what do you see in this text that's important for us?
And that same kind of thing had happened with Joshua and the people of Israel, and the way that God went before them and sowed confusion in their enemies.
His word said he's going to have victory, but you have no idea how it's going to happen. And he has more ways to bring victory than we have ways to figure it out. What else?
First, they just
provided
the water to drink and to take care of their enemies, but it also
provided
victory without them really working.
It's like the immediate, but then the long-term goal. We're going to see that again in the next chapter. Anything else? I should...
For one thing.
The prophecy was fulfilled, and the word
the hand of the Lord came upon him, the word of the Lord he spoke, and it was fulfilled so far. Now, an important thing that he says is in verse 18, this is a light thing in the sight of the Lord, right? The water, it's a light thing. But this is what the Lord's grace is like. It is grace and then more grace on top of that. This is a light thing. I'm reminded of in Isaiah 49, the Lord said, "He who formed me from the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob back to him, and that Israel might be gathered to him, for I'm honored in the eyes of the Lord my God." And he says, it's too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you a light of the nations that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. That so always, you know, this miraculous thing is a light thing pointing to a bigger thing. So restoring the nation of Israel points to the Lord who gathers the people of every nation. And so far everything is good, right? They inquire of the prophet. The prophet gets a musician, and more importantly, he gets the word of the Lord. He speaks the word of the Lord. God fulfills his word, and everything is good. The chapter should end, but unfortunately, it doesn't. And so if you look at verse 26, when the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but they could not. 27, then he took his oldest son who was to reign in his place and offered him for a burnt offering on the wall. And there came great wrath against Israel, and they withdrew from him and returned to their own land. So back to where do you go in a crisis, right? So Jehoram, where did he go in a crisis? He has no clue. Jehoshaphat knows to go and look for the prophet of the Lord. And now you have the king of Moab. Where does he look in a crisis? He's got a military, 700 swordsmen, but that's not the bad part. So he sacrifices his own son to, no doubt, the Moabite god is Chemosh. And we read in other places, Chemosh, the abomination of the Moabites. So that's his god. So he sacrifices his oldest son, and then what happens? Anger against Israel, and then what happens?
Israelites withdrew.
And then they withdrew. So, anybody see a problem here?
Well, the anger.
Lois, do you have a problem? What's your problem? That's the problem. Nobody else saw the problem. Thank you for coming, Lois. Lois is filling in for John Parker is off tonight, and thank you very much. But thank you for pointing us in the right direction. All right, so here, they have the word of the prophet. You're going to have this victory. They go to battle. They're succeeding. The king of Moab, in order to change the situation, sacrifices his son to his God, and it looks like it works. So, what
what do we make of this? Yeah, you could interpret it that way.
It says, Israel's anger was great. The meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain.
Okay, so
in your suggestion is the anger of the Moabites was great.
It doesn't explicitly say whose anger.
And that text note, the anger of the Israelites was great. So if the anger of the Israelites
was... alternate, because it does say there was great anger against Israel, but then an alternate is, so Israel's anger was great, and the meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain.
Yeah. So you have four choices. And so number one is it's the god Chemosh is angry at Israel and answers responds to the sacrifice of the king of Moab and therefore brings wrath on Israel. Now, what's wrong with that view? He is not real, and he has no power. And the Book of Kings, the whole point of the Book of Kings is the true God versus the false gods. So that's a view that is inconceivable for the writer of Kings. Although the people of Moab might believe it, there is no way the writer of Kings would write that the sacrifice of the son appealed to the god, the false god Chemosh, and he then attacks Israel. So I think you can reject that view. The second one, the Lord is angry at Israel. And this word for wrath is almost always God's wrath. Not always. Sometimes it's human anger. In fact, in chapter 5, it's the same root is used for Naaman. He's angry when he's told to wash in the Jordan. Right? So it can be human anger, but it's most often godly anger. But then, if that's the view, what is the problem with that one? Why not?
Because everything happened the way it was supposed to, except right at the end when the sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, so that view would be the king of Moab sacrifices his son, and the Lord then brings wrath on on his people that are just doing what he told them to do. So I'm going to go with Lois. It doesn't make sense, right? So it's God's wrath on Israel for something that the king of Moab did doesn't really add up. So number three is the Israelites are angry or indignant or it's abhorrent to them. And it's so despicable that they just pack up and go home, right? They're told to take it, and then they see that that these people, we don't even want to sully our hands to kill them. You know, I mean, they're it's so repugnant, and they're so horrified that they turn away and go back to go back to Israel and leave it as it is. And
but it says the wrath was against Israel.
Yeah, it said that the wrath is against Israel, but as a couple of those had said, the Hebrew is not absolutely clear, and it can be. Wrath is to them in that they're responding in wrath and anger. But to me, the problem with this is you can see the revulsion, but why would that cause them to leave? Right? You would think if they get angry, you would attack. But it would be getting angry and then withdrawing, which, you know, maybe husband or wife would do better to follow that rather than you get angry and go on the attack or remove. So it's possible, but I'm not sure. And then the fourth is that it's the wrath of the Moabites against the Israelites. And in that case, the desperate act of the king sacrificing his own son riled them to such an extent that they get another wind and go to attack Israel. And Israel is intimidated and decides to leave. And this would not be the first time they saw an enemy and decided not to engage. So in this case, the anger revitalizes the Moabites and demoralizes the Israelites, and they leave. And so they don't fulfill everything that the prophet said that they would do. And it sets the stage then for the judgment of God upon the house of Omri, Ahab, and his sons. So, I mean, you've got four choices, and there's probably more, but those the four of them that are the most common. I'm leaning towards number four, but I could be convinced of number three, but I don't like one or two. But anything else is some smart thing you've got. Well, we have time for not so smart.
Well, Moab is the king of Moab is the one who started all this when he decides he's not going to pay this.
Yeah, he's a vassal. He doesn't want to pay Jehoram the lamb's wool.
He's been doing for years.
Yeah.
And so he's the instigator of the whole thing anyway. So if you cause the fight and get.
You get what you deserve.
You lose, you can't really do that anymore.
And it's a typical thing. He's paying tribute to the power. And then the king dies to say, well, this is a good time to rebel, right? Because his son probably doesn't know what he's doing, and you know, I'll be able to get over it. But in this case, they're going to win, and then they leave. But for me, what's more important is what the true God is like. And the true God does not require sacrificing your son. He does, in fact, forbids human sacrifice. So whatever the privilege of Israel to have a God that gives by grace what the king of Moab thinks he has to obtain by sacrificing his son is a privilege that they should not take for granted. And then in addition to that, the true God sacrifices his son for his people, not the other way around. And so once again, the contrast that we have through the book is the true God versus either the Baal or Chemosh or whatever the other gods are. What is the true God like? And what he's like is the one that doesn't require the human sacrifice, but in fact sends his own son as a sacrifice for his people, and wins the victory not over a an enemy nation, but the victory over satanic powers, sin, and death, all because of the sacrifice of his son. And one of the things that we see, through the prophets and through these historical books, is the longing for the coming of the one that would do the work of God in a complete way. Anything else that's important here, or we still got another few stories to go through? All right, going once, going twice. Chapter 4. So now we have a series of stories of Elisha doing this, that, and the other thing. And they all point to the character of God, what he values, what he does, and what his purpose is in the world. And so that's what we look at in these. So in chapter 4, now the wife of one of the sons of the prophets cried to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, but the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." And Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what have you in the house?" And she said, "Your servant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." And he said, "Go outside, borrow vessels from all your neighbors, empty vessels and not too few. Then go in and shut the door behind yourself and your sons and pour into all these vessels. And when one is full, set it aside." And so she went from him and shut the door behind herself and her sons. And as she poured, they brought the vessels to her. And when the vessels were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "There is not another." And then the oil stopped flowing. She came and told the man of God. And he said, "Go sell the oil and pay your debts, and you and your sons can live on the rest." All right, so what happens in the story?
Miraculous multiplication.
Miraculous multiplication for who?
The widow.
The widow. The widow of one of the prophets. So here is one of the faithful. One of the faithful remnant suffering because of the famine and drought or whatever it is in the land. So here, faithful family going through suffering. And what does Elisha say to her? Go to all your neighbors. This is when you wish you were on better terms with your neighbors. that you can go and ask them for all their empty vessels and then secret them away in the house and close the door and see the miraculous power of God. Now I should point out, so the government didn't have a social security system the way ours taxes and then, pays later on. What was the social security system in Israel?
The family.
Yeah, and particularly the sons, the children. They were the ones that would care for the widow mother. But what's happening in this case?
creditor who has come and says that she owes money and wants to take her sons as slaves to pay for that debt.
So they're not going to be able to care for her because they're going to be paying off the debt to the creditor. It doesn't tell us why she owes or anything else, but that's her situation. There's nobody else. She has no other recourse, and she is suffering. Now, in Israel, I mean, the laws were, if you take somebody into debt slavery like this, there was a maximum of 7 years. In the seventh year, you get set free. But 7 years is a long time. Or the year of Jubilee, or one of the sabbatical years, you would be set free. But in this case, she's looking at a real hardship. Now, what does the miracle say about the character of God? Compassion for everybody, or anything in particular?
Those who are helpless, especially.
Yeah, particularly the weak, the helpless, the widow, the orphan, the stranger. These are the ones that God is drawn to. And he goes to care for this widow. Now, what can you see about her faith? Yeah, she, not like the king, right? She goes to Elisha. She goes to the representative of God. Say this, here's the need. She doesn't tell him what to do or anything. Just this is the need. She's helpless. She can only go to one place. He said, "What do you have?" "We don't have anything except a little jar of oil. That's all we have." And he tells him, and I love this. He tells him, "Go get jars, not a few." And I'm thinking, well, I'm too embarrassed to ask for like a lot of them. I'll just get a few. That should be good enough, right? But here it's like, ask your neighbors, get them not a few. And what would happen if she had gotten just a few? She might not. Yeah, she obeyed the word of the prophet, and got enough. And yeah, we don't know how old they were. I'm thinking they were, well, I have no idea.
But they kept bringing jars. They kept bringing them in.
Bringing them in, passing them on.
That's right.
She's pouring it out. She's filling it. And the Lord multiplies the oil. So, it's just, how the Lord, he says, what do you have? Well, this just, a little jar of oil, or what do you have? Well, just, I can never remember, is it five loaves and two fish, or five fish and two loaves? But whatever it is, it's not enough, right? And that's the case, and he multiplies it. And so now, what does this point to for God's ultimate view of the world? The miracles always reveal the nature of God and what he intends to do. It's grace, mercy, and a complete new heavens and earth, right? They're living in a place where husbands die and they don't have enough money to live. This is not God's intention. But there's a day coming when when there's a complete salvation of a new heavens and new earth, and people don't die early and they don't go through famine and drought. So they, as it says in Isaiah 41, "Fear not, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I am the one who helps you, declares the Lord. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel." It's one of the laws to set poor people free was not only the 7-year limit and the sabbatical year and the jubilee, but you had a kinsman redeemer that would come and pay the price so that they would be set free from the bondage of the creditor. That's what the miracle points to. It doesn't point to Elisha. It points to the God of Elisha who cares for his people, his own, and ministers to them. Or in Ruth 4:14, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, that his name might be renowned in Israel." That's the heart of God to redeem his people from the poverty and death. Any thoughts? Because we still have like 3 more stories to do, and one of them's long. All right, verse 8, the Shunammite woman. One day, Elisha went on to Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived. Now, we just had this poor woman. Now we have a wealthy woman who urged him to eat some food. So whenever he passed that way, he would turn in there to eat food. And she said to her husband, "Behold now, I know that this is a holy man of God who is continually passing our way. Let us make a small room on the roof with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can go in there." All right, so here's a wealthy woman, recognizes he's a holy man of God, and is generous to care for him. And verse 11, "One day he came there, and he turned into the chamber and rested there, and he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Call this Shunammite.' And when he called her, she stood before him, and he said to him, 'Say now to her, see, you have taken all this trouble for us. What is to be done for you? Would you have a word spoken on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army?' And she says, 'No. So I dwell among my own people.'" That is, I'm content, I'm secure. "I dwell among my own people." And he said to Gehazi, "Well, then what is to be done for her?" And Gehazi answered, and I can't help but think, I mean, Gehazi seems really on top of things until the next chapter, right? Not so much. But Gehazi answered, "Well, she has no son, and her husband is old." And he said, "Call her." And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway, and he said, "At this season, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son." And she said, "No, my Lord, O man of God, don't lie to your servant." But the woman conceived, and she bore a son about the time the following spring, as Elisha had said to her. So here's a generous woman. God gives a gift of grace that she doesn't ask for, doesn't expect. It's a miracle, according to the word of the Lord. I mean, that same word, this time next year, same words he said to Sarah. This time next year, you're going to have, it seems there's a theme through the scripture of God's delight in bringing children to a barren woman. And that would be a good place to end, but it doesn't end there, does it? In verse 18, "When the child had grown, he went out one day to his father among the reapers, and he said to his father, 'Oh, my head, my head.' The father said to his servant, 'Carry him to his mother.' And when he had lifted him and brought him to his mother, The child sat on her lap until noon, and then he died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. And then she called to her husband and said, "Send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may quickly go to the man of God." Notice this man of God, six times in this little section, it's the man of God, the man of God, the man of God, because that's he's the representative of God. And come back again. And he said, "Why will you go to him today? It's neither new moon nor Sabbath." Now, this is a typical man. Why are you going to church today? It's not Sunday, right? Then she said, "All is well." And then she saddled the donkey. She said to her servant, "Urge the animal on. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you." So she set out and came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. And when the man of God saw her coming, he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Look, there's this Shunammite. Run at once to meet her and say to her, 'Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is all well with the child?'" And she answered, "All is well." And when she came to the mountain of the man of God, she caught hold of his feet, and Gehazi came to push her away. But the man of God said, "Leave her alone, for she is in bitter distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." And then she said, "Did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, 'Don't deceive me'?" And he said to Gehazi, "Tie up your garment, take my staff in your hand, and go. If you meet anyone, don't greet him, and if anyone greets you, do not reply. Lay my staff on the face of the child." And then the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So he arose and followed her. Gehazi went ahead, laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was no sound, no sign of life. Therefore, he returned to meet him and told him, "The child has not awakened." And when Elisha came into the house, he saw the child lying dead on his bed. So he went in and shut the door behind the two of them and prayed to the Lord. And then he went up and lay on the child, putting his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself upon them. The flesh of the child became warm. And then he got up again and walked once back and forth in the house and went up and stretched himself upon him. And the child sneezed seven times. And the child opened his eyes, and then he summoned Gehazi and said, "Call this Shunammite." So he called her, and when she came to him, he said, "Pick up your son." And she came and fell at his feet, bowing to the ground. And then she picked up her son and went out. And we never know her name, and we never hear of her again, but she sees the phenomenal miracle of God. So it's the grace of God to give a son, and then this sudden catastrophe, and then this miracle doesn't act like the other miracles, does it? It's like, send him with the staff, that doesn't work. He goes and prays and lies on him, and maybe he's getting warm, maybe not, and then does it again, and eventually the Lord answers. So what is important for us in this text?
Towards her.
Grace and mercy. His character is a God of life, not death. We live in a world of death. And this is the hint that it will not always be this way. That death will be conquered. That life will be restored. And I think that's really the purpose of the miracle, is to reveal the character of God and what he is going to do. We don't see the end yet, but we see the hints of God overcoming death for all time. What else?
She was a woman of great faith already.
She was a great what?
A woman of great faith already.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know, it seems use it to bring someone to her. And she was someone who interested.
Yeah, and it's also important to recognize she does not lose her faith
when she loses her son.
There are several, but another thing, she doesn't share with her husband, doesn't, you know, tell anybody else, she just wants Elisha.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, it says that, well, my translation says, she says, all is well. All she says is, shalom.
When anybody asks anything, she says, peace, shalom. That's all. She has nothing else to say until she gets to the Lord.
Passing off God, honestly, I didn't think she really wanted to talk to him. Otherwise, she just wanted to talk to the man of God.
Yeah. And Elisha does the same thing with Gehazi. He says,
go, and if anybody talks to you, don't get diverted, right? You're not going to stay and chit-chat on the road. Go to the house. Lay down the rod. And you would think, I mean, Moses' rod, split the sea and did all kinds of, you would think the rod of the prophet representing the great shepherd of God would be able to bring healing, but no. And it took more.
With that rod, did you not
know? Nothing happened, yeah. Yeah. It's
one other observation here is that at this point Gehazi is being a cooperative servant.
Yes.
Cooperative.
He discerns and he
sees her need. Now he does try to get her away from touching. It seems like Elisha stays clear of the woman, which is probably wise. We have no clue that he's going to turn bad in the next chapter. Now, I didn't go into this, but the village is Shunem. It's in what eventually was called Galilee, and it's on the hill of Moreh. On the other side of the hill of Moreh is a village called Nain. In the village called Nain, you'll remember, Jesus is passing along, and a widow is in a funeral procession with her son. And Jesus says, don't cry. And then he says, young man, arise. So here, as always is the case, there's a greater than Elisha that comes to bring life to the dead. And so Elisha can do the rod, he can do the prayer, he can stretch out, he can do all that stuff, but all he can do is pray. Jesus comes along and can command the dead, rise up, and he rises up. And so the miracle then reveals the character of God, his eventual completion of removing the curse and removing death, but doing it through the one that's a greater than Elisha that is to come, that raises widow's sons and brings life to them. So in Luke 7, where he raises the son, fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people. And it's actually more than a prophet, but definitely great. What else do you see in this Shunammite story? My clock says 7:59. There are two more stories that we will not get to, but we will pick them up real quickly next week. So for next week, we're looking at chapters, 5 we're just going to glance at because we've done that before. We're looking at chapter 6, 7, and 8. And we'll touch on the last two stories in this chapter 4. I think we can do it. What do you think, Lois? Yeah. Well, any last words on the Moabites, the Shunammite, or the widow's oil? Our Lord and our God, we do look to you as the giver of all grace and goodness. You're the God of all life. And as the living God who brings life, you feed your people, you heal your people, you raise them from the dead, you give them victories, all by your grace and through the work of your Son. And for this we thank and praise you in his name. God bless you all. See you next week.